Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week are Jeff Ranke and Ben Munson. We each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we take the five most popular stories and discuss the implications they have on the industry going forward. But before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You could also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Ben at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. And subscribe to us on YouTube at IEN Magazine to get a notification when we go live every Thursday. Jeff, welcome back. Are you rested, recuperated? You ready to go?
I am probably like too relaxed from vacation. Yeah, it was awesome. Caught a bunch of fish, drank a bunch of beer. It was a good time to be up north. And I've sort of had a hard time getting back into it. I think I kind of really disassociated from everything at work, so which was great.
Yeah.
But just makes it a little bit harder to get back into the flow.
Yeah.
But also me back doing this.
You relax into the serenity of a northern Wisconsin lake, it's really hard to get back into, you know, quote unquote cube life.
Yeah, especially this time. I don't know. It's just weird. I guess I really, really chilled hard.
All right. We will get you ready to roll. Munson, how are you doing this week?
I'm good. I'm back.
Three in a row.
I know, right?
Series regular.
Yeah. You got to upgrade me to series regular. I'm not like going to be in the graphic yet, probably, but maybe you could like put me in the corner. Again, sometimes Ben.
Like the photo on the table, just like the three of us and then, and sometimes Ben. I like that. It's a guest starring role.
Yeah.
It's a guest starring role.
Maybe Ben will show up.
Well, it's good to have you back. Anna, please enjoy your time in California. I'm sure it's going to be great. I think she's on a plane right now, which means she's officially in the worst part of her vacation.
Well, she did say she may actually splurge and have a beverage.
Oh,
or two on the plane.
Okay.
So
the only way to make a plane all right is like those tiny bottles, you know. Okay. Well, before we get started, let's have a word from our sponsor, and I'm going to read it because, you know, it's a read. This week's episode is brought to you by SIGA Technologies. While it has always been at the forefront, more manufacturers are giving even more attention to how maintenance programs can drive greater efficiency and productivity. Register now to watch Jeff's new interview with Stephen Timms, SIGA CEO, to hear how manufacturers are increasing tool time 2 hours per day per technician. Our first story this week. Five workers picketing in UAW strike hit by vehicle outside plant. Excuse me. Man, rough start. United Auto Workers were picketing outside a Flint area General Motors plant when they were struck by a vehicle leaving the plant. Five people suffered minor injuries. Two were taken to a local hospital. The workers were blocking the driveway at about 4 p.m. when an employee was trying to leave the Flint Processing Center in Schwartz Creek. Local authorities say the employee drove through the picket line to leave the plant. GM spokesperson Jack Crowley said the company is, quote, committed to the health and safety of all employees in a statement. Plant leadership is working closely with local authorities to investigate and understand what happened, the statement also said. The Flint Processing Center is one of 38 locations where workers walked off the job last week. Jeff, I understand that this wasn't necessarily a GM worker, but a contract employee. Still, I'd like to get away from the whole narrative of he was just standing there, so they had a right to hit him.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, let's not, I don't want to make little of the fact that five people were hit by a car.
Right.
Okay, so just that's just
base level
traumatic enough.
Okay. Yeah.
Bad things happen here. Thankfully everybody was okay. I mean, a couple did have to go to the hospital. So it wasn't just like, you know,
yeah, they didn't just tap them out of the way
or something here. Yeah. I mean, it was serious. I think this is such a contentious situation. There's so much passion and fire, whatever you want to say, on both sides of this, and everybody is so heavily vested in what's going on with this UAW strike. that it leads to a lot of assumptions mm-hmm. being made. And I think what this story really shows us is sometimes we just have to be a little patient, mm-hmm. take a step back, because in this instance, you know, the UAW is basically assuming these were people who had either crossed the picket line or these were salaried employees who are going in there, basically defying what they were doing and creating a bigger headache for them when they came back to work yeah. and all these other issues. Whereas everybody else, and I think a lot of commenters on the site were looking at it like, well, you've got these people picketing and just being disruptive and surrounding a vehicle. I think the one individual on the site commented about imprisonment because they were surrounding the vehicle yeah, and all these.
This is false imprisonment.
All these other things. And the reality is it was some bad drivers from a cleaning crew.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not trying to dismiss the fact that they did something horribly wrong. Yeah. They hit people with a car.
Yeah.
That's bad. But again, it wasn't all of these other elements at play that people were assuming was really fueling the situation. But it just, man, it just goes to illustrate how prominent this story is, it's affecting every walk of life. Everybody around the country is aware, probably the world is looking at this situation, and stakes are very high. It can lead to some really inflammatory thoughts and statements.
I think it also shows the point of getting a better understanding of all the information that's out there before you start jumping to conclusions. Yeah. Because I just, almost every day, I look at some of the comments on the website and think, wow, they only read the headline and maybe the subhead and nothing more. Because I don't understand how you get to the conclusion of like, yes, the person in the car was clearly in the right and deserved to mow down these people. Like, that just doesn't make any sense to me on a human level, right? And, I mean, Ben, one of the things about this situation that kind of stood out too is that the driver's still on the lam. So mm-hmm. there might be a little bit more to the story in terms of who this person was working for the contractor and what other things might be going on that, you know, he disappeared.
Yeah, and it sounds like the UAW is taking this very seriously. Mm-hmm. In their statement from region president Steve Dawes, he told the Flint Journal, it was uncalled for, which it's always uncalled for.
Yeah, what's he going to come out?
Yeah. That was uncalled for, you know, but he also said, this is very serious and we're going to be pushing this issue. So I don't expect them to drop it, and maybe this is just more kind of, you know, bad PR for the automakers.
Yeah.
But I think in this situation, it's, you know, when I read the headline, my mind automatically went to, you know, this is somebody just plowing their car into the picket line.
Yeah, like literal union busting.
Yeah, because your mind goes to all the, you know, all the other protesters that have been hit by cars in the last couple of years. It seems like a fairly regular occurrence.
Yeah, no, there seems to be a kind of growing intolerance for people expressing their right to protest. Did either of you guys catch the name of the housekeeping contractor? Malice?
Yeah.
Not the best.
No.
Not the best.
No.
As I mentioned, police are still looking for the driver. One thing that I did notice, and it kind of stood out to a couple of workers too, was that the next day, GM told salaried employees at the plant to stay home out of an abundance of caution. Yeah. Now, there have been a lot of concerns and speculations over whether these salaried employees are kind of doing more than their typical 9-to-5, stepping in on the line and, for lack of a better term, being scabs. Yeah. Now, GM calls the claims erroneous, and there's a lot of, and you kind of mentioned this too, Jeff, that with salaried workers performing other jobs inside the facility, it could create problems when these UAW members return. There were a number of employees that kind of spoke out saying, like, it's not just whether or not we're against kind of them bringing in scabs to do the work, but also that when you bring in under or unqualified people to do a job, they don't do it right. And, you know, there are messes that need to be cleaned up as a result.
No, I thought that was an interesting point as well. They referenced actually the last time they were on strike, and mm-hmm. that was a lot of cleanup that they had to do, a lot of quality control. In this particular facility where they're processing, I forget, the hundreds of thousands of parts per month that go in and out of this place, you could definitely see, combined with some of the supply chain disruptions that are in place, that could create a mess. So you can appreciate if that is the perspective truly that they're working from, that is a legitimate concern.
Well, and it's weird how we go from a COVID landscape where it was sort of an all hands on deck. We're all working together, salaried employees on the plant floor. And now it's, no, you're scabs. Also, is scab like PC? Can I say scab? Like in a union context, am I still fine with that?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very divisive type of term. I think there are some that would definitely not appreciate it. But from a labor perspective, yeah, that's exactly what they refer to.
Okay. Other workers is what we'll say. And, you know, as we'll likely be doing updates as to where the strike stands for the big three, the United Auto Workers Union is going to announce expanded strikes at GM, Ford, and Stellantis plants if the sides don't make significant progress in negotiations by 10 a.m. Eastern tomorrow or Friday. Or for most of you that listen to this on Monday, I guess we'll see Monday morning where the strikes have expanded to, just because I haven't seen any significant, I haven't seen any progress other that, let alone any that I would call significant.
Fain did come out and say Ford is doing, they're making some progress there. And for Fain to at least acknowledge them, I think was a big step.
Yeah.
Stellantis made some inroads, but apparently not very strong ones according to the UAW. So yeah, it will be interesting to see how they expand it.
Well, and Jeff, you mentioned how this is at a global scale right now because it's already been so disruptive. Right now, only 18,300 workers are on strike. Yeah. That's only 12.5% of the UAW's 146,000 members. And we've seen layoffs at suppliers. We've seen other work stoppages. So I think hopefully we can come to terms, but we seem to be just scratching the surface of this big three strike. Yeah. All right. Our next most popular story. Golf ball maker fined after fatal fire for storing 30 times limit for hazardous material. A golf ball manufacturer in Taiwan was fined the equivalent of $75,000 on Monday for storing, again, 30 times the legal limit of hazardous material and other violations after a major factory fire killed 9 people and left one other missing. Launch Technologies had 3,000 tons of organic peroxides on site. 100 tons is the permitted limit. Organic peroxides are highly flammable and used to make rubber products, like golf ball cores. It's unclear what caused the fire, but two explosions in an already burning building is what trapped firefighters and workers under the rubble. 4 firefighters were among the 9 who died, and more than 100 other people were injured. Launch Technologies produces 20% of the world's golf balls. By law, these organic peroxides should be stored in a separate warehouse building. Launch kept the material on the first floor of the factory building. Now, the company received a larger penalty because it waited 20 minutes to report the fire and failed to give a complete inventory of the organic peroxides on site when firefighters arrived. The company has received multiple safety fines over the years, and it does claim to have made improvements over the years as well. But Jeff, in these situations, it's hard to believe when a company comes out after an explosion that kills likely 10 people and says, hey, there's been constant improvement.
No, very difficult. And I think, especially when you see the 4 firefighters that lost their lives here, whenever we look at some of these foreign safety situations, it's rare that we see this type of public and a response that's this strong. That basically, I mean, this is an OSHA type of response, which usually we don't see, quite honestly, in a lot of foreign, especially when we look over in Asia. Even if they do make these types of steps or this type of law enforcement or punitive statements, we don't hear about it.
Right.
This was very strong and very public. And again, you mentioned 20% of all golf balls. I mean, this is going to have a supply chain impact.
Oh, yeah,
big one. This factory going up in flames. So there was some positive sentiments there. And I would like to think that this comes from sort of an altruistic perspective from the Taiwanese government. But I do think there's a lot of things that they had to do that are impacting their economy that sort of forced them maybe make this strong of a statement right now.
Right.
So first of all, when you look at Taiwan, first of all, there's everything with China. And I don't think we need to go into the geopolitical history between those two countries or territories or whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
But there's obviously a lot of conflict there, and China has been definitely stepping up the rhetoric in terms of how they feel about Taiwan and maybe becoming more aggressive from a military approach to going into Taiwan.
Yeah.
What that does then, if you're working in Taiwan, even either as a manufacturer or a supplier or purchasing from them and relying on exports from Taiwan, you're going to start thinking twice about it.
Mm-hmm.
Just with that dynamic alone. So now if you start seeing about all of these different things going on from a safety perspective and with the microcosm that everything is being placed under right now with social media and just worldwide reporting, nobody wants to be attached to that type of facility.
Right.
So there's those dual pressures that I think have really led to a lot of reshoring that we've talked about a ton. When you look at the amount of reshoring that's been done just in the US since 2020, it's like 150% greater rate of jobs coming back to the U.S. from foreign areas, especially Asia. Now, primarily China, but yeah. Taiwan's in the mix there too.
Yeah.
So I think one of the reasons that we see Taiwan cracking down so hard and so publicly with this type of safety violation is, again, they've got all of these things working against them. They want to make sure that the people know, hey, we are taking this serious. This is a viable place to manufacture. This is very similar environment potentially to the U.S. when it comes to these safety infractions.
Yeah.
Especially when you're looking at the other thing that's playing a big part of this too is a big part of Taiwan's financial backbone is the semiconductor industry.
Yeah.
We're seeing so much of that also being reshored to the U.S. right now. So again, I think a lot of the reasons that we saw this type of response was, number one, it was warranted,
yeah.
but also number two, because of all these different pressures that Taiwan is seeing right now for manufacturing.
Well, and not just reshoring, but this particular application, I guess, really stands competitive disadvantage from like nearshoring, or I could see, you know, especially when you look at some of the brands that were impacted by this. Yeah. I mean, all of a sudden, kind of nearshoring to Mexico maybe starts making a little bit of sense there as well. Ben, Jeff kind of mentioned the impact on the supply chain, and it's good to see that we both found the same resource.
Yeah.
So when you stumbled upon mygolfspy.com or whatever it is, mygolfspy, did you have the same grain of salt when you looked at their reporting at first? And then you're like, oh no, this is actually great information.
Yeah. I didn't know what to think. But it was a pretty high up result for what's going on here. And this just seemed like an unusual thing for a golf publication to be covering, but I suppose, you know, this is definitely within their purview.
Yeah, well, I mean, what is it, 20% of all golf balls in the world? I mean, when you think about that, how do you think that this might impact the supply chain and some of those brands that are kind of tied to it?
Yeah, like they produce golf balls for some pretty major brands. Like they make all the golf balls for Topgolf,
mm-hmm.
and they make a lot for Callaway as well. And this was bad enough that Callaway actually released a statement saying that they're working with local authorities to get more information about what's going on. So this is a bad look.
And yeah.
And I think it's just kind of amazing how a company like this can carve out such a huge niche, you know, or such a big chunk of a market, and then still be so blatantly negligent in mm-hmm. their kind of manufacturing operations.
Well, and we talk about it all the time, right? That manufacturers or brands need to have more insights into their supply chain. And I feel like the more we talk about it, the more it seems that it's like collectively happening across the globe. But I mean, then you see an instance like this and it's just maybe not as popular, or maybe not as people aren't looking into it as much as maybe they should be.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Callaway, but that the company in Taiwan also supplies TaylorMade, Bridgestone, Mizuno, also services many direct-to-consumer companies. The customer list also includes Encore, Odin, Sugar Seed, and Penfold. The company shipped more than 260 million golf balls last wow. year, and I know at least two dozen of those I put into the woods over the course of the summer.
I can top that.
At least 2 dozen, yeah. And roughly 80% of the business is in the United States. My Golf Spy reported that this they had a source that said this factory could be out of commission for up to a year. So we're talking wow. about a huge gap that if anyone has the capacity to ramp up production and step up, they could actually, you know, take quite a bit of market share away from them.
Yeah. Golf balls are not cheap to no. begin with, too.
Yeah.
So if the supply chain is really constrained, you could see prices really go up there. And then it's hard to justify paying as much as I do for golf balls when I hit so many of them into the water. Like, I never buy really good golf balls because I know I'm just going to lose them. If I have a terrible golf ball, I'll keep that forever.
What I do is I buy like a dozen really good golf balls, right? Because I trick myself into the marketing on the packaging where it says that it helps keep them straighter. And so like I identify like I have at least 12 of these. That means I can, you know, hopefully make it 18 holes and I'll always tee off with them. And then by the 13th hole, they're gone. I'm in the bottom of the bag.
Yeah, I'm always tempted to tee off with my 9-iron because I know that's like 100 yards.
Yeah.
That's fairly straight for 100 yards. I think I should just hit that 5 times.
I'm a great addition to a scramble team. But not just great.
All short game, even when it's long.
Yeah, I need somebody on my team to go first and have that solid straight drive, and it's just like, all right, here we go. Like you mentioned Topgolf, and another thing is that Callaway owns a stake of Topgolf. So they're also pretty leveraged in that. Topgolf plans to open 11 stores annually over the next several years.
Wow.
And you can't do that if you don't have golf balls. So we'll see. I mean, as the situation continues to evolve, I mean, I could definitely see, if not this facility opening up within a year, maybe operations moving somewhere else in Taiwan. But we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
All right. Our next most popular story. Toyota Gigacasting prototype builds a third of a car body in just 3 minutes. Toyota has aggressive EV plans. The automaker wants to hit annual electric vehicle sales of 3.5 million by the end of the decade. To make it happen, Toyota wants to cut its plant investment, production processes, and manufacturing preparation lead time in half. Well, the company recently unveiled a prototype of its new gigacasting equipment that could produce a third of a car body in about 3 minutes. During a recent demonstration, molten aluminum was cooled from 700 degrees C to 250 degrees C, which I was like, man, that seems hot, but I got to put it in something I understand. So I switched to Fahrenheit, 1300 degrees Fahrenheit to nearly 500 degrees Fahrenheit. I know I should be metric. I'm sorry.
That's still really hot.
That's still hot. And formed a single die-cast component that made up the rear third of the vehicle's chassis. This operation normally takes 86 pieces and a 33-step process that takes hours. They did it in, 3 minutes? Toyota started building its first gigacasting prototype in September 2022, and the company plans to use this method to make front and rear sections of an electric model by 2026. Jeff, a lot of interesting things with this technology, particularly, my goodness, the time and cost savings. But there are some inherent risks when that much of the body is one component. And could we also talk about the development? They started working on this prototype, a year ago, and it's already pumping out a third of a car. That's impressive engineering.
It is. You know, when I first read this, it reminded me of something a long time ago. I was in the automotive aftermarket with a publication that served the automotive repair business. And they talked about this even then. This is almost 25 years ago, this whole modular approach to manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons it went away is because potentially if you're in an accident, you're not just swapping out a quarter panel. It is the entire piece when you do this type of approach. There's also this thing called a $365 billion U.S. automotive aftermarket where people sell parts and connectors and clips and hardware and all this other stuff. Guess what? They were not thrilled at potentially replacing all of these small parts with one huge cast piece of material.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and then you had the insurance company stepping in as well, because potentially if you're in an accident and this does get cracked up, you're not replacing a bumper.
Yeah.
You're pulling off the entire third of the vehicle. At which point does it become cost effective to get it fixed, or are you just scrapping this whole car?
Right.
Are they totaling it out? So there's a lot of consumer elements that in the past had sort of shut this down.
Mm-hmm.
Now I know Tesla's doing this. I think Tesla can get away with it because basically if anything goes wrong with your Tesla, you're only taking it one place.
Yeah.
Back to the Tesla, that dealership, store, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So I think when this starts getting into more of the wider spread, bigger OEs, where you're used to a more traditional approach to getting your vehicle serviced, it'll be interesting to see how the consumer responds to this dynamic. Because again, the whole replacement repair element of it changes dramatically, potentially with this type of production approach. Now, maybe things have scaled differently. Maybe they've got solutions where they can more effectively just pull off the whole back end and slap a new one on there.
Yeah.
Maybe that's all changed. I'm not the engineer here. So I don't mean to be the wet blanket that I usually am.
Yeah.
But I think there's some things that probably still need to be worked out from a consumer perspective.
So are you saying that other times you're intentionally the wet blanket and this time you're just kind of accidentally the wet blanket?
Yeah, I can't help it. I can't help it this time.
So one thing I'm curious about, when you were more heavily invested in the automotive aftermarket, how did they kill it last time? Because this one seems like it is such a done deal. I don't know how they could kill it.
I don't think the ability, especially with them from a material perspective, was there to make it as cost effective as they had hoped during the production process.
Okay.
It seems like now they've figured that out. In fact, it's really quick. I mean, yeah, it's incredible.
So they couldn't make the machine big enough to stamp it or to cast it.
Not this timely fashion and not this as cost effectively as what it appears to be now.
Okay.
It was still more cost effective. This was also, I mean, production levels were different too. I mean, this is when they were producing more cars than they sold.
Yeah.
On purpose,
yeah.
Which was not a good thing. So, like you said, maybe things have scaled differently now. It makes more sense, but those were the issues in the past.
Well, and I mean, if they want to roll this out by 2026, all I can say to the automotive aftermarket is, man, get ready for the revolution and try and figure it out. Because the other thing, Jeff, is like, and we've talked about this previously, is it's not just about repairability, but it's about sustainability and cost. Now, these cost savings are likely not going to trickle down to consumers who are going to be on the hook for these high dollar repairs down the line. But remember the story that we talked about, a couple of months ago, that the repairability of EVs in general is in doubt because of the battery. So, I mean, all of those concerns and all those markets already, I think like when it comes to the chassis, do you think that's going to kind of be second fiddle to the batteries? Just because, I mean, they're talking about like if the batteries take any damage, they're like scrapping the whole car.
Absolutely. I mean, without a doubt. I mean, the battery's the main cost. And plus the bodies and all of the different components of a vehicle become more durable. They're lasting longer. That's why vehicle ages up so much. So again, that's a part of it as well. Things are lasting longer. And like I said, the material enhancements are significant as well.
Ben, do you think with these new processes, we will see cost savings, or do we think we've kind of set the standard for what an EV, what an economic level purchase would be in an EV, and it's really not going to come down from that?
Yeah, I don't know about cost savings. Maybe costs will not rise as quickly as they have been, but yeah, I'm not so sure about that. And I really do, you know, Jeff already talked about the repairability thing, and you know, I think Tesla is really running with this. Giga casting too. We all have to call it that now. Because they do.
Because to Elon Musk had a fever dream. He's like, we're going to call it Giga.
But it's like, they're talking about, you know, they're producing a smaller car and they want to cast the entire platform as one piece. Right. And we were talking about, you know, that means a little bit of damage is just going to have, an effect on the entire vehicle.
Oh yeah. Right?
It's like the foundation of your home. If you knock out one corner, that's bad.
Yeah.
It's bad for the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so this actually impacted us just last year where, I mean, and because we talk about there being larger and larger components on a vehicle, right? We have, I mean, the Yaris is what, an 08? And we hit a raccoon. And I mean, that raccoon took like the entire front end down. And it's like, I mean, like you can't just replace one small piece. It's like, no, you need to replace at least half of the car from the outside. You need to replace everything, the half of the car in the front. I mean, granted, it's plastic, but you know, you don't want anything dragging. It's just, I mean, when we come to gigacasting and creating fewer components and larger components, it is going to be costly to repair these things. And I think like when it comes to EVs, I don't know. I'm like the biggest thing when it comes to sustainability and repairability with the EVs, I think those might be bigger red flags than a lack of charging infrastructure. You know, I mean, Jeff, we're just going to see like I mean, I'm used to seeing, we pass a junkyard on the way to my in-law's house, right? And you're used to seeing like the crushed cars all stacked up. But I mean, you're just going to see fields of these things parked until they kind of figure out recyclability and repairability.
It feels like it. I mean, yeah. I think that's definitely an issue. I mean, with the batteries already, that's something we're trying to get ahead of, more out of necessity because of all the rare earths and all the other elements that are in those batteries that we need to recycle because they're so difficult to get to. But yeah, if we get to a point where this gigacasting reshapes the way we produce vehicles, and it won't just stop at vehicles if it works. I mean, we could see it going into a lot of other larger pieces of equipment that we use on a regular basis.
Oh, yeah.
What will that mean from a recycling perspective? That will be interesting to see.
All right. Our next most popular story. 77-year-old boat maker announces layoffs. St. Peter, Minnesota is a small town of 12,000 people. It is also home to Alumacraft, one of the oldest operating boat manufacturers in the United States. This week, Alumacraft parent company, BRP, which bought the company back in 2018, announced it'll lay off 68 workers at the plant. BRP says the factory will go down from two shifts to one, and officials say the, quote, very difficult decision was a result of, quote, current marine industry realities. The layoff news comes after BRP announced plans to build a new boat manufacturing facility in Chihuahua City, Mexico. The plant first up, I can't say plant or first or open, but I'll get Chihuahua. Yeah. The plant first opened in 1946, and Alumacraft was one of the first aluminum boat manufacturers in the country. The St. Peter plant will hang on to about 207 workers, and local officials hope those laid off will be, quote, reemployed very quickly. Jeff, I guess one saving grace with this is that given their likely skill set and the demand for manufacturing jobs, I know that whenever we run a layoff story, that's like the positive thinking is that at least they'll probably catch on with somewhere new soon.
Agreed. You would think so, especially metalworking, which is what these folks were highly involved with. When you look at the company name, Alumacraft, I mean, they're aluminum boats. And I think that is part of the challenge here for this company a little bit. Just when you look at the raw market data. Now, when you look at a fiberglass boat, that can be used in a lot of different areas, sailboats and larger vessels and things of that nature. So with Alumacraft, with being an aluminum boat, primarily not, you know, it's not strict bylaw or anything like that, but primarily you're looking at hunters and fishermen. Okay. Yeah. That's typically who's going to go after an aluminum boat. You can definitely use an aluminum boat to, you know, take some kids tubing and have some fun out there, but it's going to feel a lot different because when that aluminum boat comes down, you are going to feel every single wave, every single hit. So traditionally, if somebody is going to go out for more recreational purposes, they're going to trend towards a fiberglass boat. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's one market dynamic that is working against Alumacraft here. Okay. The other thing is during the pandemic, we didn't have anything else to do. Yeah. There was a lot of people buying boats.
Yeah.
So they got one.
Yeah.
So they're not necessarily looking to upgrade. And again, these aluminum boats, one of the positive things about them is they're lighter.
Yeah.
And they last forever because they can take a beating. Unlike fiberglass, typically when you get a fiberglass boat, you use it, it gets beat up. You either are trading it in because it's beat up or you're upgrading to a larger one. Mm-hmm. So you're selling it and buying. There's a lot more turnover within that marketplace than those who are using aluminum boats, especially for fishing. So I think there's those dynamics are in play there. The other part is the whole inflation element. Everything's more expensive now. I mean, somebody referenced that on the site and it was, I think they're dead on with it.
Oh yeah.
So if you're looking at, well, I've got this kind of beat up Alumacraft that I've had for 25 years, but when I look at what a new one costs to replace it, I can deal with this for a little bit. Plus, I do like the fact that it's lighter, gas mileage, you know, the amount of gas it's consuming, all that type of stuff. I can throw it around a little bit more than maybe a different type. I'm just going to stick with it for now. So I think they're battling a combination of factors here.
Well, you nailed a couple of things. One, our John boat up at the cottage, aluminum boat, like you said, light. You can launch it with two people easily. You can almost launch it with one person just walking it in. And it's a sturdy, reliable boat. Again, it's a great fishing boat, and we don't use it for any sort of sport fishing or anything like that. But the other that you talk about are the market conditions. Like, if you've looked into buying a boat lately or any boat components, like at all. They are insanely expensive. My brother sent me a potential new motor for the pontoon boat, and I looked at the cost and I was like, my God, we'll just buy a new pontoon boat for that. So then I went looking for a pontoon boat to send him, and I'm like, never mind, a pontoon boat is more than my house. Yeah. So everything's crazy expensive. And one thing I thought, you mentioned COVID, is that I thought things were going to cool off after COVID because, like you said, everyone's got a boat. And I thought more people would be kind of willing to part with those. But the market is staying kind of, or the aftermarket is staying really strong. Let's see. What does Mark from ECD say? He says, Aluma Gigacast boats.
You're on it, Mark.
Perfect,
I
Mark.
I agree.
Well, I mean, it kind of fed into the story perfectly, Jeff, because the first time... When I was working in an injection molding facility and they were making spatulas, I was like, oh my goodness, can you imagine when they can start making bigger parts, right? Yeah. And I mean, now my kayak is an injection molded one-shot kayak that they made in probably 45 seconds. So there is some real opportunity there if you can figure out how to do that. Ben, one of the one of the red flags when it came to BRP were some of the reasons they gave for the market conditions. Did any of those in particular kind of stand out to you?
Yeah. One of them did. it was they.
Funny you should ask. Yeah,
they partly blamed the layoffs on unfavorable weather in the Great Lakes region, which is a little, you know, ambiguous.
ambiguous. Yeah, yeah,
but it's. I'm not exactly sure what they're talking about here, but as someone who spent the last summer in the Great Lakes region, I could say, yeah, there was a lot of unfavorableness to go around. Smoke, excessive heat.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of this prevents me from boating, though.
Yeah. No, I was trying to think of, I mean, in terms of unfavorable weather, when we did the fishing charter, there was a little chop, but I was like... that one stood out to me too, where I was like, actually, no, the Great Lakes, it's been pretty solid, And it looks like the charter fishing industry, from my perspective, they're doing just fine as well. So that was kind of a random one, but I understand. I mean, do you think part of it is that they're just trying to deflect from the whole, yeah, a few months ago, re-announced a new plant in Mexico and we're moving things there?
Yeah, I mean, you have to provide some sort of explanation for layoffs. And you know they can blame sales, which is probably enough.
Yeah.
So it was curious that they would choose to add this wording in there and not kind of expand on it.
Yeah, they said so. What it was a 9% revenue decline in their marine segment, right? Mm-hmm. And you're right. They said lower volume of boats sold, which makes sense based on all the points that we shared. Jeff had extended supply chain issues. Everyone's feeling that. It's just like you just have those two and people start to understand. But then, and the unfavorable weather in the Great Lakes. Like, whoa, what the? Where'd that come from? Jeff, when you were on your respite, did you have any unfavorable weather?
We had some rain, but you know what? we figured it out, David.
Yeah, you got back in that boat. Because,
you know, when you're going fishing in September, October in Wisconsin, you're going to have to deal with some unfavorable conditions.
Are the unfavorable conditions that the Great Lakes still freeze?
I'm not sure.
We can't even use this region for like 4 or 5 months out of the year. No one's buying boats.
Can't boat on the ice.
Right. So maybe, to your point, Munson, about the... these extreme weather events are actually going to lead to more favorable conditions because, you know, once we get a little bit further down and the Great Lakes are open year round, you know, more boats.
Yeah. And I have to kind of question how much of a growth industry boats are. I mean, these are, you know, well-made products.
Yeah.
I think we had an Alumacraft canoe. And it was pretty sturdy. Like, it could have fallen off the car on the way to the lake, and we would have just picked it up and put it in the water. I mean, these things last a long, long time.
You should have, you know, you maybe buff it out a little bit, throw a couple of sparks. But we had the same thing. I was actually surprised that you don't still see more aluminum canoes. We had one of those up north too. I used it pretty frequently with my family, and then one time I just showed up, gone. And I called my brother. I'm like, yo, where'd you put it? Just because it is aluminum, sometimes you put it up out the back or you just lean it up against the side. He's like, yeah, I sold it. No one ever used that thing. I'm like, what? Like, we use it like every time. And he's just like, never saw you. I'm like, oh, so you didn't use it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But, you know, we replaced it with a likely injection molded canoe. And now when that thing hits a rock, you just see the gouge in that thing. Like, whereas, you know, you just kind of glanced off it with that aluminum one. A little bit more about the Mexican plant announcement. The company said that this plant would, quote, position the business for success to meet consumer demand for its products, be more efficient, and drive market share gains. There's the important one right there. They're all about driving market share gains. So, I don't know. A lot of times, I feel like sometimes they just got to fill out that press release. And they're like, you know what? Throw something about the Great Lakes in there. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I can think about there is when we do have these dry runs, like the water level goes down. Oh. So you do have to be careful about wakes and all that. But again, that's not why you buy these particular boats.
Yeah.
So I'm still struggling there.
These boats are perfect for when the water's down.
Yeah. So, yeah.
It's all right. It's all right. They'll figure it out. They'll figure it out. They don't want to just be like, yeah, we're moving because it's cheaper. Sorry. All right. Well, our most popular story this week, China's export of two key rare minerals drops to zero. China is making some changes, all in the name of national security. The country is a key exporter of certain rare minerals that are critical to the production of computer chips and solar panels. The country is responsible for the production of 80% of the world's gallium and about 60% of germanium. China didn't just pull back on sales. In August, it exported none of it. What's an export? Sounds like a bad exotic car. I drive an export. Some say it's retaliation in a tech war with the U.S., and Chinese regulators now have to approve any exports of these key minerals. Analysts call the move, quote, a double-edged sword, considering it has already caused supplies of these commodities to balloon and prices, specifically for gallium, Jeff, have kind of fallen through the floor.
In China.
In China, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, this is an interesting one. I mean, and this is, hey, David, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
Yeah.
When you look at each one of these individuals, so gallium first. So we haven't made or processed anything here in the U.S. since 1987. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to assume that's because it's a real dirty, real expensive process in terms of extracting this particular mineral from all the different places it can deposit. I think it's in zinc and iron and some other places you have to extract it. So very messy process. We could do it here.
Yeah.
But then you have to go back to President Biden and his administration that has been not so mining friendly, shall we say. Yeah. So there's a conflict there that we're going to have to make some decisions. You look at germanium. We do have a germanium mine here in the U.S. I believe it's in Utah or Washington. So we do have some options there. There's also a lot from Canada that we can rely on in the short term, potentially. So we do have some options there. But man, like you referenced, so much of it is coming from China. And if they want to hoard it,
yeah,
basically it comes down to kind of who's going to blink first here. Because they want us to ease up on some of the chip imports coming into China.
Yeah.
So they'll start exporting this stuff. They said they have made some exceptions. I'm going to guess one of those is probably Russia. Okay. They probably have no problem sending it over there, but maybe not anyplace else. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be very interesting. And not only is it the political conflict between China and the U.S., it's also a conflict here at home. Again, we've talked about this with all of the minerals and all the stuff we need for all these EV batteries. What are we going to do? Because mm-hmm. we can get at this stuff, but it is a dirty process.
Yeah.
And it's something, again, that our current political structure just does not want to bend on when it comes to mining, allowing access to where we can get at these minerals and actually doing the mining, and then all the other controls that are associated with it, which I'm not opposed to because we need to keep things clean.
Yeah.
I'm all about that. But then we also need to provide resources potentially to make sure these companies can do it in the right way.
Right.
So there's just a lot of different variables at work here. Who's going to go first?
Yeah. Well, and part of it is that this 20% gap in gallium and the 40% in germanium is spread all over the globe, Ben. So it's, I mean, we're not just talking about, oh, okay, well, you can't get it in China, you can get it in Europe. It's like, no, you can get a handful of over here, you can domestically get a little bit for yourself. So if this supply chain stays cut off, it is going to be very problematic for multiple industries.
Yeah, I mean, this is, it's been called retaliatory.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, you would think this is something that maybe they kind of had in their back pocket, you know,
yeah.
For a while now. But you, when you look at, you know, in July, China exported like 5.15 metric tons of forged gallium and 8.1 metric tons of forged germanium products, and then zero in August. So this huge drop off. And they say there's a you know, authorization program in place and that it's working, but it doesn't seem to be. So you would think this is probably something that they knew they could do for a while.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like they put a process in place to actually not completely blow up their own, you know, supplier industry.
Yeah. And their own economy. One thing is that when you're dealing with products like this too, is that it takes, the group that kind of exposed this, it was the Critical Raw Materials Alliance. And I feel like if it's not for little niche groups like this in every industry, nobody notices it until it gets really bad, until it's already way too late. But we had talked about some of the other places you can get it. So China struggling with weak domestic demand, also a housing crisis right now. So China's got its own problems. Last month, the country's exports suffered the biggest drop in more than 3 years. So while this is retaliatory, I mean, to Jeff's point about who's going to blink first, it's not going great for China either.
No, that's a great point. And I think what's kind of lost here too, and I guess I just want to make sure it's clear, like this isn't just about EVs. Just looking again, some of the comments on the sites, this is about anything that takes a chip.
Yeah.
This is all electrical, electronic devices here. So the impact is widespread. But like you said, China's got a lot of economic issues at home. So this is a kind of a bold move for them.
Well, and while there are alternative producers, there are also substitutes for both materials. But it's kind of like any substitute, right? Where it's almost as good. And it's, do we want to have a long-term plan that is making products with almost as good materials and bringing them to market? I don't think that that's a good solution.
So let me ask both of you this question. So when we hear about these types of developments, and it's all focused around chips, which is, you know, EV is a big part of that right now, but it's really around the semiconductors. But then we've got other power sources potentially out there. Now, I know like hydrogen and sodium batteries aren't necessarily a replacement for chips, but they would lighten the load or they'll lighten the need for some of these other some of these other minerals, elements that we need to produce some of these high-end electronics.
Yeah.
Do you think when these types of headlines come out, does that sort of embolden some of these other developers of these alternative technologies a little bit more? Is that kind of like put a little more fuel in their tank, if you will?
Ben, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it has to, right? I mean, it's the when somebody kind of hamstrings themselves like this, like China has done, it opens up opportunities for other people. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of the way it works, right? When something goes wrong, someone is going to be there to fix it.
Yeah, I think so. But I do think that one of the things that has been interesting about the EV movement is that it's like we picked a clear winner, right? Like we picked our VHS over Beta, or we decided against the CED disc, right? But with EVs, we've been like, okay, EV is the clear winner, but we still want to put a lot of money into hydrogen development and other alternative power sources because we're not 100% sure. You know, so I don't know. That's been one thing that's been encouraging. And we have seen a lot of developments like I would say that hydrogen is kind of like the dark horse pick here.
Well, it just seems like the more stories we run like this, the equivalent number of stories that we hear about for hydrogen development applications.
Yeah.
So it seems like it's just really been over the last 6 months that there's been more hydrogen focused stories, developments, whatever you want to say. So it's, I don't know. I find that really interesting.
All the hydrogen startups are just like, keep doing it, China. Issue another press release. We're going to do it better. All right. Well, before we move into In Case You Missed It, let's hear another word from our sponsor. This week's episode is brought to you by SIGA Technologies. While it's always been at the forefront, more manufacturers are giving even more attention to how maintenance programs can drive greater efficiency and productivity. Register now to watch Jeff talk to Stephen Timms, SIGA CEO, and hear about how manufacturers are increasing tool time 2 hours per day per technician. Jeff, people are running out of time. We're closing the gate on this one soon.
Check it out, man. A lot of really interesting stuff. It's actually a relatively short video. It's not going to take a ton of time, but there is a great deal of information packed into that short video. Mm-hmm. Definitely recommend you checking it out.
That's right. Get your 5 minutes with Steven right now. In case you missed it, the stories maybe not as popular on the website, but still stand to make a big impact on the industry going forward. I'll start with mine, in case you missed it this week, just because I was surprised that so many people missed it, because it's about Legos, right? And normally, whenever we run any coverage about Lego,
agreed,
it pops. But then you mix a little bit of sustainability in there, and everyone's like, oh, yawn, sustainable Legos. All right, woke people, just give me my old oil Legos. I don't want them to be any different. Now, a little more than 2 years ago, Lego unveiled an experimental brick from recycled plastic bottles. We talked about it here. A 1 liter bottle provided enough raw materials to make 10 Lego bricks. Well, they make 10 Lego bricks, but not any cleaner. This week, Lego pulled the plug on the project. It does remain committed in its quest to find sustainable materials to reduce carbon emissions, but this was not the process to get it done. Lego, quote, decided not to progress with making bricks out of PET. It turns out that even after 2 years of testing, all they found was that, quote, the material didn't reduce carbon emissions. Still, the company remains committed to making Legos from sustainable materials by 2032. So we're just, you know, as you do in development, we're just failing forward. You know, one less off the list, or one off the list. The company has already spent more than $1.2 billion in sustainability inititives. So, a costly miss.
Was that just on this?
No, just overall. Yeah. Overall. Yeah. Like, Lego's trying to be completely sustainable by 2032 and going after it. Now, Lego is still testing bricks made from a range of alternative sustainable materials, including other recycled plastics and plastics made from alternative sources like e-methanol. And I had no idea what e-methanol was, so I figured I'd let you know too. E-methanol is composed of waste carbon dioxide and hydrogen created by using renewable energy to split water molecules. Now, that's what e-methanol is. I'm not sure if I know any more about it. I chose the story because when we first ran the story, I thought the real risk was going to be with IP and playability, right? Because we've seen a lot of materials made from sustainable plastics that just don't have the look and feel as the original, right? And what was Lego initially, they were the most concerned with the snap, right? How the two Legos go together. I was surprised, Jeff, that this one came down to, it turns out that we didn't reduce any carbon emissions.
Yeah. I think it just, you know, kind of goes into the fact that we're still getting the process right. Like, the science is there.
Yeah.
But we still need to refine the processes. We're so focused on functional efficiency, like the end product, how well it works. We look at vehicles, what's the gas mileage, how long between charges, those types of things. Well, the process is important too. That's one of the things that we were just talking about, hydrogen. That's what's holding hydrogen up, is it's still a dirty, expensive process right now to create hydrogen. Mm-hmm. You know, with the fact that, you know, you called it failing forward, I actually kind of agree with that term here.
Yeah.
We figured something out. This one doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's just, it's too expensive to do. It impacts productivity. It impacts our cost model. Okay, we're going to shut it down. But it's encouraging to see Lego sort of setting an example of, we're going to try this stuff at least and see what we can do.
Well, and it's so often, Ben, when we run these stories about sustainability initiatives and companies trying to go greener, for lack of a better term, or to be a little bit more concise, we always hear people say, like, oh, they're doing this and it's not the best path forward. Actually, you know, they're just kind of doing it for the PR or because they're forced to. So I thought it was really good of Lego to come out and be like, hey, you know what? We're working on it. The last plan didn't work. Quite costly, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. But we still are sticking with our plan of having it done by 2032.
Yeah, it's pretty rare for a company this size, at least, to come out and say, you know, we are still working on it. We didn't just like drop this kind of sustainability goal a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. And then never talked about it ever again, yeah. Or never even really did any work toward it. It seems like they're making an honest effort. And Lego has a pretty sterling reputation. So this is something they have to get right.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a really high quality product. I don't know if you've ever tried to assemble like generic Legos.
Oh, yeah.
They are not the same. They're bad. Yeah. It's like, this is not fun. Yeah.
No, it's like, so what do you need to, it has to be like, what, 10% different in order to have any like infringement claims? And man, whatever that percentage is, that is quite important when it comes to an offshoot Lego.
Yeah, that's a big 10% because it throws the whole thing off. Yeah. And Lego, I mean, you think of it, the bricks are pretty small, but they produce a massive amount of them. I think I read once, don't quote me on this, that Lego is actually one of the largest makers of tires in the world.
Oh.
Just because of all the little rubber tires that they make.
Oh, interesting.
They technically count as one of the biggest tire makers in the world.
That's interesting. Like, and when you talk about a well-made product, so for my son's third birthday, he just received a tote of Legos that my cousins played with their entire childhoods. They're now in their mid-20s.
That's awesome.
And man, like when I passed on my bin of action figures, it was rare that they had all four limbs, you know? But that bin of Legos still stuck together like the day they came out of the package.
Probably still as painful to step on too.
They are. Oh my goodness. We tried letting them play with Legos outside. So it was the combination of like being on a tarp and stepping on a Lego in grass is still as bad as stepping on it on hardwood or a carpet.
Yeah. I think on April Fool's Day, my daughter thought it'd be funny to put Legos on the floor in the bathroom. So I went in there at like 4 a.m, totally dark in the house. And I stepped on them with my bare feet, and that's I just fell to the ground.
That's like some Jigsaw stuff right there.
I know. I was like, she was like, yeah, got you. I got you good. And I was like, yeah, you did. That was really terrible.
So are they the biggest tire manufacturer?
I think, yeah.
Okay, so, okay. This is from producer Alex. According to Guinness World Records, Lego's tire production peaked in 2010 when the company churned out 381 million tiny tires. Since then, it has held the record for the largest annual volume toy tire manufacturer. These days, production floats around 306 million rubber tires every year.
That's a lot of tires.
That's incredible.
Crazy.
Yeah, the one that you can step on and it's not going to hurt. All right, Jeff, what's your In Case You Missed It this week?
So I picked a story, UPS to hire 100,000 holiday workers this year. Kind of giving you some of the high points. Obviously, they're shooting to hire 100,000 workers for the season. You remember they had that big almost strike with the Teamsters Union. So one of the things that was interesting here is that for the pay for package drivers is going up from $21 to $23 an hour. And for package handlers, they increase from $15.50 to $21 an hour. Whoa. In order to try to meet their goal of all these numbers. And it's going to be difficult because UPS is looking at the fact that there is a shortage of workers out there right now. There's a lot of different options out there, but they're hoping this bump is going to have a significant impact. Also, they have seen that in the last couple of years, nearly 50,000 of these seasonal employees have turned into permanent positions.
Oh, okay.
And they've refined their hiring process to the point that applicants can get a job offer within 20 minutes of filling out an application.
Wow.
So they are going very fast. Yeah. They're paying extremely well. And this stood out, number one, because it will be interesting to see if they can hit their goal.
Yeah.
Of doing that just because of the labor market right now. The other thing I couldn't help but think about with all this talk with the UAW strike, if this plays out for an extended period of time,
yeah,
I mean, that strike fund can only go so far. And if they're going to continue to expand the number of people on strike, at some point, would they not have a lot of people that might be like, I need to go back to work in terms of former UAW workers might look at something like this and say, well, I was working in a plant. Yeah. I can drive a truck or basically unload boxes, doing almost the same thing at some of these distribution centers for pretty good pay. And you've got another very strong union backing you that's already successfully fought for significant pay wage increases, insurance benefit improvements, all of those things. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see. Also, I mean, this is just always interesting when we get to this time of year to see how UPS can just handle this flood of packages that flies at them, which is only getting to be more and more all the time with online, with e-commerce and Amazon and everything else. So just very interesting. And the thing that, again, that caught my eye is a job offer within 20 minutes of completing the application.
Yeah.
So maybe not as selective as other positions, but still a very quick turn.
I wonder what kind of like a process they have where as you're filling out that application, there might be like trigger words where it's just like, hire them now.
Yeah. What kind of application is this? You just submit like your age and your name.
Yeah.
They must have a really good background checking mechanism in place where they kind of know more about you than they should or something.
Or it's, I feel like it's like when you take like a survey and it's on pages. So it's like 20 pages to actually fill out the application, but maybe by like page five, they already know, like, just get them in the door. Just, we have your social security.
We have your social security number. You're not wanted for anything. You do have a driver's license. You're good.
Well, and you raise a good point because I mean, maybe not for a permanent solution from their job, but maybe in the interim, some sort of seasonal employment. If this winds up being a long standing work stoppage, that definitely could be, that seasonal work could help fill those gaps. I mean, when you started floating some of those numbers, I was just like, well, what are the hours? You know, like, yeah. How many weekends can I sacrifice with my children so that way they can have a magical Christmas? But no,
David's going to buy them snow.
That's right. That's right. We'll be like Dana White and ship in snow when it doesn't snow on Christmas. Right. Ben, I mean, we have seen some interesting moves when it comes to hiring practices. And I mean, because we've seen everything from on-the-spot hiring at job fairs. It's interesting that people can fill out an application and kind of like within 20 minutes. I don't even know if I could fill out an application in 20 minutes.
I would imagine this is pretty high turnover work.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, do you think a majority of this is like sorting?
Yeah. I feel like it's, oh yeah, it's packages off the truck onto another truck. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's not glamorous work. You know, it's going to be hard and it's going to be backbreaking. But, you know, that's why they have to raise the rate like what, $6 an hour just year over year.
But think about that too. How many seasonal jobs have a Teamsters union behind them? I mean, that's impressive. I think it's a big draw.
Yeah.
Didn't mean to cut you off, Ben. Sorry.
No, that's all right.
Well, let's give him another chance to talk. Ben, what was your, in case you missed it this week?
The story I chose was Honda designs tiny EV for children's hospitals. And I checked the numbers on this one just to see, just in case you guys missed it. And it looks like mostly everybody missed it.
It was missed. There's no in case.
But I wanted to surface it again because I think it's a great story. Honda is partnering with local dealer associations to produce 60 small electric vehicles for children's hospitals across the U.S. The Shogo is a one-seat vehicle capable of speeds between 1 and 5 miles per hour. It includes several like fun features like a horn that plays cheerful sounds and stop-and-go paddles on the steering wheel instead of pedals. Honda engineers also borrowed a lot of parts and design elements from the companies like IndyCar and its go-karts to build this thing. And I think it's a great story and it's a cool thing to do for kids who are stuck in the hospital. But, you know, the more I read about it, I just want to ask you guys, does 5 miles per hour seem kind of fast to be driving a go-kart in a hospital?
That seems pretty hot. That seems like you're coming down that hallway pretty hot.
Yeah, 5 miles per hour feels pretty slow in a parking lot, right? Mm-hmm. But when you're in the hallway, that you could really,
I mean,
be breaking some
You could
ankles.
Take somebody out.
Yeah, but I mean, you could take out the doctor, and then that's terrible, right?
I mean, the hospitals have some long hallways, so you could probably really open it up.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of handy people out there. I feel like if you got a lot of time next to a Shogo, maybe you could get the regulator off and maybe after hours really give it, you know, really go after it.
Yeah. Do you think this is a good use of their design team? I mean, it's their performance team that handles like kind of racing development in the U.S. And they've had one of these in use, I think, since 2019.
Yeah.
In California, but now they're kind of expanding the program. And I mean, is it just not interesting enough? Or
oh no, no, it's too well spirited.
Too nice.
It's too nice. It's way too positive. People are just like, oh, that's good for them. No, it's the same when we do engineering teams that lend their expertise to create 3D printed prosthetics for children. Right, we see the same numbers where people are just like, well, good for you. But no, I think this type of work is what the manufacturing industry needs, right? It shows the capabilities of top of the line engineering and manufacturing. And it shows how it can, you know, some of these manufacturers aren't just like large, faceless, capitalistic monoliths where, you know, they also can make a real impact for a child that's in the hospital.
Yeah. I also thought it was kind of interesting because Honda hasn't really made much of an inroad in the U.S. with EVs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is kind of an interesting place to start with little ones in the hospital.
Yeah.
No, I thought it was a really cool story. I think sometimes what happens with these is when they look at the headline, you're like, Honda designs tiny EV for children's hospitals. You feel like you've got the whole story.
Yeah.
Like you can see it right there. But digging into it, there's so many greater points that were brought out within the story. It was, I enjoyed it a lot. One of the things that gave me a little bit of the feels is when they talked about developing what's kind of, it almost looks like a spoiler on the back, but it's actually for like the IV
to
bag.
To hold the IV bag, you know? Yeah.
All those different design elements. And it took me to the last story. But I can finally say it, David. I think this is one of those things that leads to the thing as well. When you look at the different.
He did it! He made it!
Dropped it. Thanks, Ben. You made it happen. Because when you look at the amount of attention that needs to be paid to the kids in terms of nurses and all of that kind of stuff, if you can potentially develop an autonomous version of this that can get them to where they need to go, I mean, it kind of lightens the load from a labor perspective. And also, you know, it helps the kids feel a little better about stuff when they're going from point to point in a hospital of all places.
Well, it's also fun. You know, so like it solves logistic challenges, but all the video that you saw of the kids using them, you know, they were always smiling. And these are kids that are in rough situations. And if you can just lighten that load 1% for them,
absolutely,
you are doing the right work. One thing that stood out for me was the name, was because I was like, okay, if Honda's going to bring a design like this to the U.S., why call it the Shogo? Something that seemed, you know, not as, something that I would consider a name for the U.S. market. But the name is derived from a Japanese phrase that means soaring into the future. So the Honda soaring into the future would be a little bit long.
It's a little wordy.
a little hard for like the side of such a small car. But no, I thought that was, after I looked it up, just a really excellent name for these things, particularly for who they're serving. So, all right, well, let's jump into, in case you missed it, we're going to go to final thought and a reminder to go click the link below in the description so you can check out this story. There's still a lot to it. And we know that you haven't watched it yet. All right. Our final thoughts. Ben, what's your final thought this week?
Okay. My final thought is about a tree. 16. I was just reading about this. A 16-year-old boy was arrested for deliberately cutting down a famous tree in England. It's a 200-year-old sycamore tree, and it was in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Oh.
It's near the beginning of the movie when Kevin Costner and Morgan Freeman first get back to England, and they're walking along that little wall, and Robin Hood pulls some mistletoe off the tree, and he says something like, "Many maids lost their resolve to me because of this plant." And then Morgan Freeman is like, "In my country, we talk to our women. We don't drug them." And anyways.
That's a great pull.
Yeah. Anyways. Yeah, I love that movie.
That is a fantastic movie. Yeah. I was figuring this was the tree that when all of a sudden they see Christian Slater's character that he's hiding in.
Yeah, no, this is the one that the kid is hiding. Or no, he's hiding another tree nearby, that kid in the beginning. Okay. So this is the tree that leads to the tree.
Very good, very good.
But anyways, I was like, why chop down a tree for no reason?
Yeah.
And this was a 200-year-old tree. Very cool. People love it in England. It's like the most photographed tree in England, I think.
How did he give a statement why he chopped down this tree? Like, was
in the photo, it's
mom,
the
actress?
It's a pretty clean cut. So I don't know what kind of equipment this 16-year-old kid had, but it looks like this is not the first time he cut down a tree.
Is this, I mean, what is he trying to like sell it to Planet Hollywood? I just don't understand other than like just general vandalism.
Well, yeah, it's cut down and it's just tipped over
like
right
it,
there.
It blocked his view of something.
Yeah.
Like, so what are they going to do to this kid?
I don't know. He's been arrested. I'm not sure what kind of punishment there'll be, but I mean, he's a minor, but still, it's like, why cut down a tree? Man. I mean,
kids.
What do you think your dad would have made you do?
If I cut down
a 1600-year-old
super
tree?
Super famous, 200-year-old tree from Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
I would still be planting new trees.
Yeah. Actually, because of the angle to Prince of Thieves, my mother would just be out of her mind upset about it.
Yeah.
Just because anything Kevin Costner related, which she has passed down to me, and I lovingly embrace it. You know what she would say to me? She would say, "I'm going to carve your eye out with a spoon." If you remember that. Wait, heart. He's going to carve his heart out with a spoon? And then he's like, "Why wouldn't you use a knife or something?" He's like, "Because it would hurt more, you twit."
Yeah.
You guys have watched this movie a lot.
Yeah. It's fantastic.
It's great, yeah. I hope Kevin Costner gets involved.
Yeah.
Sees this tree from his best movie.
Maybe. I don't know.
Hot take.
Yeah. They're like, "Man, we got to do something." But I don't know what you do at this point. But
no.
It's like, don't cut down a tree for no reason.
You would put Robin Hood over Field of Dreams?
Oh, I don't know. They're both pretty good.
Or Draft Day.
Yeah. Tin Cup.
You know, if we could maybe try and figure out a way to like manufacture some sort of Prince of Thieves memorabilia out of it. Mm-hmm. Oh, like turn it into a cottage industry. Well, I mean, there's nothing to do now. Maybe like a limited series of bats.
That is like the third best Robin Hood movie.
Third best. I don't know. What are you putting on top of that? Not that Russell Crowe monstrosity.
Well, that Russell Crowe movie was so much better than the Kevin Costner one.
Yawn.
The best one, though, is the Walt Disney cartoon.
Well,
with the foxes.
Yeah.
That one's the best.
Oodalali. All right. My final thought this week, other than disagree, was this week I had the opportunity. Well, no, a couple weeks ago, I had the opportunity to join Lou Weiss and Tim on the Manufacturing Talk Radio podcast. And it went live this Monday. So I really appreciate everybody that's checked it out so far. And, help support that podcast and our podcast. But you can check that out on our website. It's on both IEN.com and manufacturing.net. You can also check it out on Manufacturing Talk Radio on YouTube, and they're on, you know, all the podcast platforms. But we had a good conversation about AI, 3D printing. Actually, Tim's son is a master with 3D printing. He 3D printed this Mandalorian helmet, and he was just like, "Oh, look at this thing that my son made." And he's pulling it out from under his desk, and it looks like off the set. It was incredible. Mirror finish and everything. Really incredible. But we had a great conversation. You know, it's one of the top manufacturing podcasts out there, and I, recommend that you give it a listen. And thank you again, Tim and Lou, for having us on. Hopefully we can work together a little bit more. Just, when you get two powerhouses like the Today in Manufacturing podcast and Manufacturing Talk Radio, it just stands to reason that you got to do more together. You know?
No arguments here.
I also want to reach out to Lindsay, who sent me an email with a recommendation, because last week, if you remember, Ben, we were talking about what you bring back with you. Like when I brought up Cloverfield Paradox and Alien. She said the Andromeda Strain is a must-see when it comes to that. Have you ever seen that?
No. I think I've heard of it, though.
Okay. I think it's like Michael Crichton. But the library knows it's en route, but it didn't get here fast enough. So I'll report back later. Thank you, Lindsay. And anyone else that has sci-fi recommendations, please keep them coming. They are a weakness for me. Jeff, what's your final thought this week?
So as you alluded to before, I was up in the Eagle River enjoying some time up north. What was really cool is my brother was actually up from Arizona. So I was up there with my brother, my sister-in-law, and my nephew. And one of the things we got to do is my dad had this old Winchester 22.
Oh.
And when he passed, my oldest daughter and I cleaned it up. Like, it was so dirty. We actually punched the tube and like dust came out the other end of it.
Yeah.
But we cleaned it all up. And in the process of taking it apart, basically right now, if you take a rifle apart, there's a lot of plastic pieces and stuff that snap together. This just has a wooden like handguard, and the whole stock is wood. So every of these metal pieces just fit into how this wood was carved out. It's incredible how we guessed this rifle is around 80 years old.
Yeah.
Just how precise everything fits in there. It's incredible. So it was cool to go up there. We had the gun all cleaned up. My brother and I shot it and stuff like that. Just did some targets and things. So it was cool. It was a cool illustration, or just to do that with my brother, obviously. Yeah. But also to just look at the craftsmanship. It's sort of a representation of all the things that we talk about in terms of quality for U.S. manufacturing. It went back all these years. Again, if you looked at how well this gun was made and how well it still performs 80 years later, it's pretty cool.
Did you have a, they don't make them like they used to type moment?
I did, because in taking this apart again, I bought a newer one, because that's one of the things my daughter really enjoys doing is shooting. And it's all plastic parts, and it works, and it's lighter and all that, but it is nowhere near as accurate as this 80-year-old 22. Yeah. It's incredible.
No, very similar experience with my brothers. And, you know, my brother has a gun safe with a number of handguns and stuff. And whenever we go to the range, handguns malfunction, rifles malfunction. Grandpa's rifle never malfunctions.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah, keep it simple. All right, well, before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. Producer Alex thinks Robin Hood Men in Tights is the number one Robin Hood out there. This is maybe number four.
Tied for third.
To email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, Ben, or Alex at IN.com to wax poetic about the Men in Tights and how it launched Dave Chappelle's illustrious career. Just make sure to put email the podcast in the subject line or just Men in Tights so we know what you're talking about. Please subscribe to our daily newsletter so you can get the podcast delivered to your inbox first. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube at IN Magazine so you can join us live every Thursday. For Jeff Ranke and Ben Munson, and saying hello to Anna, who is likely now landed and having a great time on the West Coast, I'm David Manti. This is the Today in Manufacturing podcast, and we'll see you next week.